At 08 hours UTC, we are broadcasting to Asia in the 16-meter band shortwave and on 240-meter bands medium wave. We continue transmissions to Europe in the 25-meter band shortwave and on 227 meters medium wave. Listeners in Australia and New Zealand can receive us in the 16-meter band shortwave. And you can hear us on digital radio in London, UK. Please stand by for the news on the hour, followed by other features. For more information on our broadcast, please visit our website at english.ruvr.ru, and our email address is world@ruvr.ru.
To the whole world on AM, and you can hear us in London on digital radio. We're working for you, and all your suggestions and requests are most welcome. You can reach us at world@ruvr.ru. From Moscow, here is the news. First, the headlines. Russia has sent another two plane loads of humanitarian aid to Japan. The Libyan authorities have invited international observers to confirm the declared ceasefire. A referendum on changing the constitution is underway in Egypt. Those were the headlines, and now the news in full. Russia has sent two more plane loads of humanitarian aid to Japan, which was hit by a destructive earthquake. The planes have flown in 40 tons of goods, medicines, tents, blankets, and prime necessities. Russia has already sent several consignments of humanitarian goods to Japan, where more than 160 rescuers have been clearing the wreckage and providing medical assistance for the population in the worst-hit areas in the northeast of Honshu Island. The quake that hit Japan a week ago is the most powerful in the country's history. It has brought about catastrophic destruction, and the death toll stands at 18,000. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin is meeting today with officials on the far eastern island of Sakhalin to analyze the current state of the country's nuclear power sector and discuss the planned construction of new nuclear power plants. The prospects of developing the fuel and energy complex of the Russian Far East and additional fuel supplies to quake-stricken Japan will also be on the agenda. Radiation levels across Russia's Far East remain normal, according to experts monitoring the areas in the wake of the recent explosions at Japan's Fukushima 1 and 2 nuclear power plants. The Libyan authorities have requested China, Germany, and some other countries to send monitors to confirm that the declared ceasefire is really in place. Tripoli said it halted military action following the adoption by the UN Security Council of a resolution providing the enforcement of no-fly zones over the Jamahiriya and delivering strikes on the North African country. But the Western nations are skeptical about the declared ceasefire. According to reports, the West may launch a military operation in Libya virtually hours after an international meeting on the situation in the North African country is held in Paris later today. A nationwide referendum on making amendments to the Constitution is being held in Egypt today. The presidential term in office is planned to be reduced from the current 6 years to 4 years, with president allowed to hold office for no more than two consecutive terms. The mass-scale anti-government protests that erupted in Egypt in January this year caused President Hosni Mubarak to step down. He handed powers over to the military, which suspended the constitution and disbanded parliament. The referendum should now pave the way for parliamentary and presidential elections in Egypt. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has registered to run for another term in office Ignoring complaints by his opponents that his candidacy violates the Central American country's constitution, Ortega, who represents the country's ruling Sandinista party, will be running against ex-president Arnoldo Alemán and Fabio Gadea, a businessman. The presidential elections are set for November the 6th. The Russian submarine fleet has turned 105. The Imperial Russia Ministry of the Navy ordered on March the 19th, 1906, that submarines should be seen as an independent type of combat ships. The holiday has been marked as Submarine Day since 1996. You've been listening to the news from Moscow.
You're tuned to the World of Russia, coming to you on short and medium waves worldwide and on digital in London, UK.
Outlook, politics, economics, culture, a glance from Russia.
Hello and welcome to the program. In this edition, United Nations Security Council has authorized a no-fly zone over Libya, Hurricane Katrina versus Japanese tsunami, and from Siberia with love. This and more in this edition of Outlook. People across Japan and foreign rescuers working on the Honshu Island observed a minute of silence on Friday as the nation mourned the victims killed during the devastating earthquake and the tsunami that hit northeastern Japan a week ago. The mourning ceremony began at the same time when the first 9.0 magnitude tremors struck on the afternoon of March the 11th. Meanwhile, the damaged Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant still poses a grave concern. The Japanese self-defense forces on Friday were helping to cool the plant's third reactor by jetting out water from seven military vehicles into holes in the reactor's containment vessel. About 50 tons of water was pumped inside as army helicopters continued to dump water from the air. As a result, radiation levels at the station have slightly decreased. The Fukushima plant's operator, Tokyo Energy Company, has warned, however, that this could only be a temporary decrease and said that more controlled releases of radioactive steam may be needed to reduce pressure in the vessel of the second reactor. All of the plant's six generating units are now in trouble. 30 elite firefighting brigades have been dispatched to the scene to assist in the relief operation as specialists keep struggling to restore power supply and restart the cooling systems of the first and third reactors to bring the situation under control. The Japanese Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency has announced plans to seal off the damaged Fukushima reactors in sand-filled concrete shelters, similar to what was done at Chernobyl back in 1986, but this time the case in point is not one but four reactors. Vladimir Kuznetsov, Nuclear Safety Director of the Green Cross Russia, gives his view.
This is the only thing that is really justified, because hardly anyone will be able to invent anything else.
This is the most acceptable option.
The point is, however, that all processes needed to be more or less stabilized before construction begins to prevent any future emergencies,
said Vladimir Kuznetsov. Turkey Energy Company does not rule out building a sarcophagus, but says that it may take months. Most specialists agree that Fukushima 1 was damaged beyond repair. Yaroslav Stromberg, first deputy director of the Kurchatov Institute in Moscow, says that, as a power-generating facility, the Fukushima nuclear power plant has been entirely lost.
There's no stopping the processes that have already begun. As an industrial site, the station has been lost. But this is not a big loss. The tsunami destroyed dozens of plants and factories and killed thousands of people,
said Yaroslav Strombach. Deputy General Director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Alexander Bychkov, has dismissed fears of a possible nuclear explosion at Fukushima 1, saying that although the situation is really hard, it remains under control. The IAEA is planning to send observers to Fukushima to measure radiation levels. IAEA General Director Yukiya Amano
met with Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan to discuss the Fukushima issue and requested more information. Russia has been conducting hourly radiation monitoring in its far eastern areas, as well as in the Sea of Ohotsk and the Sea of Japan, in the wake of the Fukushima breakdowns. So far, the radiation background does not exceed the allowed rate. And that was commentary from Alexander Batutin.
Just to remind you, you're listening to our daily feature, Outlook.
The Libyan authorities have declared a ceasefire in the fight against the rebels, said Libyan Foreign Minister Moussa Koussa in Tripoli on Friday. However, according to news reports, the hostilities are still going on. Meanwhile, in Moscow, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev gave instructions about guaranteeing the security of Russian diplomats in Libya. In his declaration, the Libyan foreign minister said that at the same time as a ceasefire begins, the government will immediately start talks with the opposition and will protect all foreigners and foreign assets in the country. Mr. Koussa pointed out that the introduction of a ban on military and commercial flights over his country will have a negative impact on the Libyan people's lives and will prevent Libya from performing its international contracts. In his opinion, it was illogical of the UN Security Council to approve a military intervention in Libya because this is a violation of the UN Charter and Libyan sovereignty. The minister also called on the international community to send a commission to Libya with the aim of investigating the circumstances that resulted in an armed conflict. This is how Irina Svyagolskaya, an expert from the Institute of Oriental Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences, comments on the information. Let's hear what she has to say. Gaddafi's quick response to the UN Security Council's resolution can be explained by two factors. The first is an intention to respond in any way. It's quite obvious that some countries, in particular France and the USA, are gravely concerned about the situation in Libya and will not stop short of military action there. The second explanation is that Gaddafi wants to make a pause and think what to do next. Actually, I believe that he is the main problem for himself. Even if he respects the ceasefire and begins a dialogue with the opposition, I am not sure that this will satisfy the major part of the international community. Gaddafi has already discredited himself as a ruler, so much so that without his departure, the prospect of NATO's military interference will remain. The only thing Gaddafi can hope for is permission for himself and his family to leave the country. I cannot see any prospect of the restoration of the situation which existed before he sanctioned an armed conflict with the opposition, said Irina Zhagolitskaya, an expert from the Institute of Oriental Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences. Konstantin Kosachev, the chairman of the Committee on International Affairs at the Russian Parliament, says that he considers the decision of the Libyan authorities to a ceasefire a sign of common sense. It's too good to be true, however, he said, but we would very much like this to be true. This was the Russian MP's comment on Moussa Koussa's sensational declaration. Meanwhile, Bernard Valeroux from the French Foreign Ministry said that France is cautious about Libya's decision to comply with the resolution of the UN Security Council. Gaddafi's regime is frightened. But whether Libya respects the UN Security Council's resolution or not, there is still a threat to the security of the country's citizens, the French diplomat said. In any case, NATO has not announced any change in plans. More so because news coming from Libya about the country's air force bombing the towns controlled by the rebels continues. According to one of the opposition leaders, Gaddafi is fooling the international community. That report was from the Voice of Russia's Alexei Chernychenko. You're listening to Outlook, a weekday feature of the Voice of Russia World Service.
The U.S. Justice Department has published a report detailing the findings of a 10-month-long investigation of the New Orleans Police Department. The need for such investigation arose when, after the August-September 2005 Hurricane Katrina, numerous cases of unjustified violence by the police against the local population were reported. More details from our observer, Boris Vakhonsky. The Justice Department's report does not address in detail the 9 cases of criminal investigation to the activities of the NOPD. Some of the cases have already been brought to court and several officers have been convicted. Anyway, the findings of the report are striking. The report states that New Orleans police officers have often used deadly force without justification, repeatedly made unconstitutional arrests, and engaged in racial profiling. NOPD has long failed to adequately protect New Orleans residents because of numerous shortcomings, including inadequate supervision and ineffective methods of taking and investigating complaints. Poor recruitment, bad training, and ignorance or disregard of policies contributed to a lack of confidence and even a distrust of the police. That, in turn, contributes to a violent crime problem that police have found difficult to control. The report states that lethal force by police included the firing of guns at moving cars, which risked hitting the driver and turning the car into an uncontrolled weapon. It also said inadequately trained dog handlers couldn't keep their dogs from biting suspects. New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu, who actually initiated the investigation after taking office in May 2010, called the report sobering, but not surprising. He also pledged to introduce policy change and practical reforms into the activity of NOPD in concept with the new city police chief, Ronald Serpas. What is striking is the racial bias found in the activity of New Orleans police. About 60% of the city's population are African Americans. Even with this ratio, of the 27 instances between January 2009 and May 2010 in which NOPD officers intentionally discharged their firearms at people, all 27 of the subjects of this deadly force were African Americans, states the report. In 2009, officers arrested 500 African American males younger than 17. During the same period, 8 white males in the same age group were arrested. The general conclusion of the report is that these are facts pointing to the racial bias of the police. Whether this is true or whether it is explicable by a much higher criminal rate among the African American population, it clearly shows that the highly publicized racial harmony that American officials of all levels love to boast about is no more than a myth. Being politically correct in word is one thing, living and interacting in a multicultural society ravaged by sharp social contradictions is another. It is hardly surprising that the initial push for such an investigation came in the wake of the 2005 Hurricane Katrina. It was one of the worst disasters to strike the Gulf Coast of the US in decades. And that event highlighted the contradictions that eventually led to excesses on both sides of law enforcement. While hundreds of thousands were displaced and fled from their homes, those who remained used the opportunity for looting the empty homes. Quite naturally, the attempts to stop the looters resulted in the excessive use of force by police, and that, in turn, led to the deterioration of the whole issue and the escalating of tensions among the population, not all of whom are criminals, even in a city with a criminal rate as high as in New Orleans. Alas, looting during natural disasters is common not only for New Orleans or the US in general. Cars were broken into and items therein stolen during the 2007 floods in Great Britain. Lootings took place during the earthquake in Chile last year and so on. But the 2005 New Orleans events are outstanding in these respects. What is striking, though, is that we are presently observing a situation that is completely different. The disastrous catastrophe in Japan has led to consequences much more devastating than even Hurricane Katrina. But almost all observers point out that there were virtually no lootings whatsoever in the disaster hit areas. Even such small things as bottles of water are not being stolen. So perhaps before rapping others for the excessive use of force, we should all become a little bit Japanese. And that was commentary from our observer Boris Volkhonsky.
You're tuned to the voice streets of Russia.
Outlook, politics, economics, culture, a glance from Russia. Relations between the United States and Pakistan have definitely seen better days. It looks like in recent weeks, America has tried to do everything to push tensions up to their highest level. Vladimir Gladkova, Observer comments. The controversial release of CIA contractor Raymond Davis infuriated Pakistani society, leading people to believe that their own government is being manipulated by the U.S. This probably became the last straw that exhausted the patience of Pakistan's military chief and drove him to condemn the latest raid by U.S. drones, which killed about 40 citizens. Due to such actions, the U.S. does not only risk losing a key ally, but also causing destabilization of the situation in the region, presenting opportunities for extremist agitators. The release of Raymond Davis became a surprise for everybody, from the victim's lawyers to international observers. Davis was accused of murdering two Pakistani citizens who, according to his own statement, had tried to rob him on the street of Lahore. While the U.S. government was insisting that the CIA contractor had diplomatic immunity, right-wing religious and political leaders were demanding his prosecution. Davis was released by a Pakistani court after the victim's families stated they had received the so-called blood money and could pardon the murderer according to Sharia law. The acquittal has sparked protests across Pakistan. The protesters are demanding justice, claiming that the families of the victims were coerced into accepting $2 million compensation in exchange for a pardon for Davis. According to the victims' lawyers, the whereabouts of the families have remained unknown since the news about Davis' release has emerged. As the BBC reports, a senior Pakistani official revealed that the deal had been brokered by the Saudi government. According to Siddiqul Farooq, a spokesman for the PMLN party, that leads the coalition in the Punjab province, relatives of the victims made a pilgrimage to Mecca earlier this month and collected the money before returning to Pakistan. Meanwhile, critics of the deal point to the fact that only 4 days before the release, the families said they wanted justice, not compensation. The response from Pakistan's leading political parties was mixed. While Jamaat-e-Islami and the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf parties led public protests against the release, the JUIF, the country's largest Islamic party's response, was conspicuously low-key. Analysts believe that the reason for this was the fact that Davis was released under Sharia law. Meanwhile, another scandal has done further damage to the already sour relations between the U.S. and its ally. Pakistan's army chief, General Ashfaq Parvez Kayani, condemned the latest attack by U.S. drones. The general said that the attack, which killed about 40 civilians, was in glaring violation of human rights. Most of the victims are believed to be civilians attending a tribal meeting, Jirga, in North Waziristan. U.S. drone attacks are a long-standing reason for growing tension between the U.S. and Pakistan. But while the Pakistani military often makes statements about civilian casualties, this was a rare occasion when an official has openly criticized the U.S. Army. It's highly regrettable that a jirga of peaceful citizens, including elders of the area, was carelessly and callously targeted with total disregard to human life, said General Kayani. It has been highlighted clearly that such aggression against people of Pakistan is unjustified and intolerable under any circumstances. General Kayani also stated that such acts of violence make it harder to fight terrorism. The tragic event also created massive outrage at Pakistan's intelligence agency, which is often accused of allowing and even supporting the air raids. While the level of discontent continues to grow inside Pakistani society, it's still hard to say how serious the damage of controversial actions of the U.S. will be. However, one thing is certain. The risk of losing an important ally in the war with terrorism has become more obvious than ever in the last weeks. This item was contributed by Vladimir Gladkov.
Outlook. Politics. Economics. Culture. A glass from Russia.
Books about the Third Reich continue to hit the bestseller list in Great Britain. Novelists, historians, and science fiction writers are equally attracted to the phenomenon of Nazism. The Voice of Russia's Sergei Sayenko writes, Alan Corwin's book of humorous stories, published in 1975, entitled Golfing for Cats, has a swastika on the front cover. Corwin had probably noticed that the most popular titles in Britain in those days were about cats, God, and the Nazis. 36 years on, Nazi books are even more popular. Last year, 850 books about the Third Reich went off the press, while the year 2000 saw the release of only 350 such books. Readers in these books are offered conjectural view of what would have happened to Britain if the Nazis had won, and what experiments they did with flying saucers, and why they consulted Tibetan monks, showed interest in the lost city of Atlantis, space exploration, and time travel. One couldn't possibly say, with any degree of assurance, whether it's good for the British to be so obsessed with this topic. But it is certainly good for the British book publishing industry. The top 100 books on the Third Reich have earned publishers £12 million. In view of this, I don't think that publishers care a lot about the ethical aspect of this problem, Sergei Sayenko writes. Still, there is a clear threat to the British young people's mindset, and it's difficult to predict the consequences. So how this popularity of Nazi books can be explained? Definitely, there are certain reasons for that. In 1940, not long before the Battle of Britain, the largest battle fought by the country's air forces, Winston Churchill said, "If the British Empire and Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will say, this was their finest hour." That epoch continues to look as interesting as time goes by. Brits have been widely discussing the issue on the web. A man from Kent says,
"I think part of our interest stems from liking to know about a nation regime we defeated. The more we know about its power, knowledge and influences, the more powerful we seem. Additionally, I believe that there is a less of a taboo surrounding the subject in England, as we see ourselves as the nation that defeated the Nazis. As Winston Churchill said, this was our finest hour, so why should we not remember it and be proud of it?"
Another browser, Chris from Belfast, notes,
"I don't see the problem with books on the subject of the Third Reich being popular. The Nazi regime was one of, if not the most evil that has ever existed. A terrible, terrible regime that cost the lives of millions. However, that does not mean that it is not highly interesting. Whether we like it or not, it is part of our history, and the Nazis shaped the world we live in now. I have a collection of Nazi militaria, which includes weapons, army documents, armbands, postcards, and many other items from Nazi Germany. I'm not glorifying Nazism, rather just saying, look, these things happened and we can't change them. Holding history in our hands, whether in a book or an actual item, is important, valuable, and essential to understand our present world."
These two commentaries don't sound suspicious or anything like that. Elderly Brits remember well the horror of the Nazi regime and losses of World War II. And we should hardly expect any pro-Nazi marches in the UK, similar to those we frequently see in the former Soviet republics, Western Ukraine and Latvia. Commenting on a rally staged by Waffen-SS veterans in Riga a few days ago, Russian senator and chairman of the Committee for International Affairs, Mikhail Margelov, rightly noted that such events undermine the basic European values and put in doubt the sincerity of those who claim to share them. This article was contributed by Sergei Sayenko.
And there we end this edition of Outlook. Thanks for listening.
Outlook. Politics, economics, culture. A glance from Russia.
Worldwide, listen to the Voice of Russia from a Russian perspective. The Voice of Russia broadcasts in 160 countries and 38 languages. And you can join them on short and midi waves worldwide and on digital in London. News, views and discussion. Current topics and only real people. The Voice of Russia, bringing Russia to the world 24/7. We welcome your feedback and suggestions on world@ruvr.ru.
Next in the Voice of Russia World Service News in Brief. Today, troops loyal to Muammar Gaddafi have entered Benghazi, the opposition stronghold to the east of Tripoli. Reports from Al Jazeera TV channel claim that they heard explosions in the area of Benghazi. Two Russian emergency ministry planes have arrived in Turkey with 40 tons of aid for the Japanese who have been affected by the March 11th earthquake and subsequent tidal wave. On a return flight, the aircraft will take back home another group of Russians wishing to leave Japan. 100 Russian nationals have thus signaled their wish to return. Japanese nuclear experts have restored the cooling system at the generating units 5 and 6 of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex, which was badly affected by the powerful earthquake and tsunami. The cooling system at units 1 and 2 is due to be restored today, while on Sunday, the cooling system is expected to be brought back to normal at units 3 and 4, where the situation is seen as the most dangerous. All signs are that the core zone of reactor 3 has melted down and a massive release of radiation is quite likely there. That's it for News in Brief.
In Between.
Hello, you're listening to In Between on the Voice of Russia with me, Donna West.
And me, Dmitry Bostov. The Russian Federal Customs Service says it seized 20 iPads that two men tried to illegally import into the country.
How big of a market is Russia for gray imports, and why has smuggling electronic gadget goods become such a regular thing for so many frequent travelers?
Well, we're going to look at this today on In Between. Well, it seems the Federal Customs Office says it's found 20 Apple iPad 2, just the newly released ones, units that people were illegally trying to bring into Russia from the U.S. It's the only place where they're officially sold right now, the United States.
Right, well, apparently two male passengers were coming through the Domodedovo Airport in Moscow. One of these passengers had 13 iPads. Another had 7. So they didn't declare the goods. They went to this green corridor that says, I have nothing to declare, and they were caught.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's regulations saying that duty free cannot exceed 1,500 euros, given that the price of the iPad is what?
I think the lowest retail price is $500 in the States.
Yeah, okay, well then 13 or 7 add up to...
Definitely above this limit.
Exceed the 1,500 threshold, yeah.
But you look at the number of units these guys had, 13 and 7. How did they get them? Because as I understand it, there are huge lines and out-of-stock issues, people queuing up and waiting and just kind of ordering in advance and still not having these units in their hand. How are these Russians going to the United States and buying up all these iPads?
Well, is there still that thing that they used to have when the first iPad was released, that they could sell no more than 2 per person?
Maybe, but then if you have, like, your family members and everything, then maybe you can...
Lined up.
I don't know, I've seen some blogs. It's kind of interesting because you'll have a lot of, I guess, disgruntled people who have been waiting in line. They see all these Russians and they go and they say, why are all these Russians here? Some guy came up and tried to buy, you know, my new purchase off me for $200 more. And I don't know, maybe it's something that people are really kind of noticing. I don't know, because we're not actually waiting in lines for iPads mm-hmm. in the States, but, you know, maybe our listeners
we're not
can
actually,
relate.
We're not actually doing this, but I think I know the answer. The thing is that in Russia, everyone seems to be absolutely into these things. Really
it's
into
hip.
These.
Yeah. It's like the hipster style.
Yeah, exactly. Like moving from a PC, which used to dominate, I don't know, 98% of the computer market to
PC.
Apple.
I thought you were talking about like politically correct.
No. I mean, personal computers, you know, Windows-based machines or, I don't know, Linux, but not Macs.
Well, this is what was available here.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That was the thing.
That was the market.
You could go to the store and that was one thing you could buy.
Mm-hmm.
But now, of course, this Apple trend is hitting the world and, of course, hitting Russia, too.
It started with the iPod, actually. Ever since the iPod became available as an MP3 player, people started buying those up. They found that, wow, Apple designs really nice things. And they thought, oh, maybe I'll buy the Mac. And then they bought the Mac. And then they thought, wow, this is so cool. It's like a subculture.
I think it's happened not just in Russia. It's probably a trend that we see worldwide. You know, whether you agree with this, whether you are a fan of these items or not, it's just something that I think defines contemporary culture and also is a part of Russian contemporary culture. The big difference here, though, is that we don't have these big stores and we don't have this, you know, official sale at the same time as it goes on in the U.S. So people know that there's a new item and the initial thought is, oh, I want that too. I'm not going to wait. How do I get what I want?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So what I'm saying is that these guys were bringing in 13 plus 7 iPads to resell them here at a huge premium.
Right, because how much are they going for if you search some sort of ad on some social network or something?
Around 100,000 rubles, which would be something like $3,000.
$2,500. I think that this is like even up to $4,000 is what some of these items are reselling for here in Russia. That's a huge profit that these smugglers are making.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing is that people don't really realize that this is smuggling, that this is illegal, that they're not paying any taxes.
It's taking money away from the state budget because a lot of the revenue that the budget gets is from these customs duties, and this is actually why lots of goods that are sold here in Russia are far more expensive than they are in the United States, or even Europe for that matter. It's because of these import duties that companies, when they import goods legally, are required to pay. And of course that cost is felt by the end consumer as well. But if someone is going to the U.S. on some sort of, you know, electronic high goods sort of thing shopping spree,
mm-hmm.
That just doesn't seem right to me, that his trip is more than paid for, and he's making a lot more than people make a month just
by reselling something at a more expensive price.
It just seems so sneaky and so wrong. It really doesn't make me happy at all, and I just don't understand why people would pay so much more for something that they could go and buy themselves or just wait for.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is that Russians really like to show off. Seriously, I mean, a young generation of Russians, the well-off generation of Russians, yeah?
This really started with cell phones, too, when they first came here.
Yeah.
I have to upgrade. It still is the same.
I have to have the latest cell phone roster. It's still the case, especially with the iPhone, yeah? And when it comes out, when any product of Apple's comes out, like the iPhone or the iPad or the new Mac or something like that, yeah, the MacBook Air.
It's not just Apple, there are other brands. Yeah, this is probably just the most, I would say, widespread, popular. This is something that's, like we said before, hipster, cool, trendy, whatever.
Yeah, whenever one of these comes out, these trendy guys want to have the latest unit in their hands as soon as possible. But they want to show
their
friends.
At any cost?
At any cost, it seems so. I don't understand how this works, but that's the way it works. What I don't like, you said this doesn't make you happy, right? This whole trend of people making a profit or even paying more. Both sides. What I don't like about this whole thing is that, I don't know, on my Facebook, for example, you always find at least a dozen people offering to smuggle things like that for you. So it's like your friend or your acquaintance or someone, a person that you know, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't come over and kind of, I don't know, post up an ad on the internet he's selling. He comes over and he starts selling at a profit to his own friends.
Yeah.
I don't understand this.
That's just not nice at all. I've had people ask me to bring them stuff. And I guess I'm just too nice of a person because I did that. And I mean, nothing big, nothing exceeding these customs duty duty, you know, limits or anything like that. But still, I didn't ask them for any more than I paid for it.
Well, that's kind of decent, and that's honest, and I understand that. I mean, it's your friend's request. You're doing it at the same price you bought it. I mean, your friend might kind of reward you with something, which is not materialistic, you know, not with a sum of money, but something else. I don't know, take you out to the cinema or, like, buy you dinner. I don't know. Yeah. That would be nice of them to do. But otherwise, I just don't see how people tend to make profit from their own friends, yeah? And it's become such a huge trend. It started off with the first iPhone, I think. That was in 2008 that I asked some of my friends whose company was ordering iPhones from the United States, right, to bring them over here. Of course, there was a problem of jailbreaking because they were all fixed to work with AT&T, with contracts and stuff like that. And so just, you know, Russian hackers or programmers would charge.
I have a market for this, but...
Yeah. It's not there any longer.
It's still around, though. No, it is, because even right there at the metro station where we work, there are signs that say iPhone breaking.
Unlocking, yeah?
Yeah.
Wow, okay, I didn't see that. But, I mean, it was big at that time, and that was the only concern that people had. So it was kind of cool to have an iPhone because it wasn't sold in Russia, and at the same time, everybody knew that you had to kind of jailbreak it. And this is why some of them would work really erroneously in Russia, because some of the services wouldn't work, some of the, I don't know, SIM card features wouldn't work. You wouldn't be able to reach a certain person from time to time. It would just glitch all the time because it was not done professionally.
I don't think that's necessarily related to only the jailbreak software. There are glitches that happen in every phone system.
No,
technology,
sure, sure.
Isn't it?
Sure. But I think it's because it was done kind of, you know, on somebody's lap, someone who's unprofessional, who's not providing this service officially, that it kind of added up to the glitches and the way the phone worked. Maybe they forgot to turn on certain features. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a technical specialist.
Yeah, of course not.
But it was kind of cool. And you didn't see that much of a gray market for these phones in terms of, you know, reselling. When the second phone appeared, right, everybody knew that the iPhone was already really cool and trendy.
No, but when the second phone arrived, that was the 3G model. That one actually was made available for official sale in Russia through the mobile operators. They had not a specific...
Not instantaneously. It took a while. It took a couple of months to actually get
it
officially.
Yeah, it did, but
here.
Then they finally did sell them officially here, and they were with contract deals with all the mobile providers, so you weren't buying a phone that was locked to any particular, you know, service, but it was definitely something that you were paying for because you didn't have one of these.
And how much did they cost, do you remember? They cost
$1,000,
yeah. $1,000 when they cost so much less in the United States.
But you were locked into a contract in the United States, so that's different too. I don't think maybe people realize the sort of penalty you pay when you break the contract in the U.S. Maybe the Russians who are buying them didn't quite understand that, you know, this, if you don't pay a mobile phone bill, it goes against your credit report. But I guess for some Russian tourist who comes for shopping, he doesn't care about that. Maybe he will when he doesn't get his visa, you know, the next time he tries for one, though. Who knows?
I don't know, but I remember that it took a while for them to appear officially, and therefore, over these 3 months, a lot of my friends and sometimes colleagues, they would already have the iPhone 3G, and I asked them, how did they get it? And they said, well, I actually paid somebody to get it from the United States. And I said, how much did you pay? And they said something like, even more than this official price of $1,000 that we had, so like $1,500.
I just don't get it.
Because
I
they
really
want to be
don't.
Trendy. That's the price that they pay to be fashionable and trendy. I mean, that's the craze. There's demand for it, and therefore there's supply. I guess that's the way it
is. Whatever.
There's one particular blogger, his name is Anton Nosek, and he's really into Apple products.
Okay.
And I think he might be very familiar with this whole trend of imported Apple products into Russia.
All right, well, let's then talk to him.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
All right, we're joined now by Anton Nosek. He's a very popular blogger here in Russia. Thank you very much for joining us. Please tell us, why are electronics so much more expensive in Russia than in the U.S.? I mean, these specific really popular brands.
Well, part of that has to do with Apple's corporate policy, and partly it's taxes. But this situation is rather exclusive in the case of Apple, because some devices manufactured by Korean companies or Taiwanese companies cost nearly the same in Russia as they do in the United States. And also in the case of Apple, there is that specific trend and fashion factor. People are paying a very serious premium for the possibility to be the first ones to lay their hands on the new devices which arrive to the Russian market with a serious delay. There is nothing like this anticipation when we talk about Samsung's products or LG products. People are not trying to be the first ones to try them out.
Okay, so what is so special about Apple that makes it, you know, with young people, makes it really popular, makes them want to pay a huge premium for it?
Well, I must admit that Apple products are really special. I guess I didn't say anything you haven't heard before. I have a son who is now 3.5 years old, and I have a father who just turned 80, and iPad is a computer of choice for both, and both find it very easy to use and operate, and I must say so do I. So I have 4 iPads in my family. The other thing is, I see absolutely no point to be in any rush to buy iPad 2, because the improvements are very scarce and theoretical. So I will not be paying any premium for iPad 2, and I will not stand in any queues, not in the Fifth Avenue, not in Moscow's Garbushka, to get my hands on one, because I know its functionality, and I know I don't need it that urgently. On the other hand, there are many people who will take pride in the fact that they are seen with the iPad 2 6 months ahead of the start of Russian sales for that device.
All right, well, since you're such a big Apple fan, as I understand, before, when you wanted to get your hands on some of the new Apple products, which took quite a while to get to the Russian market officially, how did you do that?
The way our president does that, I either went to America and bought them, or I had someone bring them from America for me.
Well, with the president, that was Stephen Jobs offering him.
No, not everything. Stephen Jobs offered him an iPhone 4, but the iPad he got personal imports.
Okay, so did you have to pay a special premium to do that, or not?
Well, I personally order in Apple stores in the United States and have it shipped to the address of someone of my friends and relatives who is going to Russia in some predictable future, or else I do it when I'm in the United States myself.
So that's pretty convenient. Why don't people in Russia do that?
Because not everyone in Russia has friends and relatives who are frequently coming from the U.S. And on the other hand, those coming from the U.S. usually have dozens of people asking them to bring Apple devices. And if you take official customs regulations, the limit for personal imports without tax is 55,000 rubles, which means slightly less than $2,000, which means one iPad fits, maybe 2 iPads may fit, but 3 already do.
Okay, well, I think we understand then that there's definitely a demand for these products here in Russia. It's popular, trendy, whatever you want to call it. How then is it that the company itself isn't making the products available here earlier so that they can cash in on the profit earlier from the Russian market?
Because the company simply doesn't care. Because the company has its clear and understandable priorities. It should be noted that Apple doesn't have the logistics in place at the moment to start shipping iPad 2 to the European Union. And that's a priority. And Asian markets are a priority, because there are hundreds of millions of prospective buyers in the Asian market, and they are as keen to get their hands on new iPads as are the Europeans and the Americans and the Russians. Russian market is relatively small on one hand, and on the other hand, an absolute majority of Apple products that make their way into Russian market do not via personal imports. Therefore, there is no big reason for Apple to circumvent this quite natural process and place an accent on illegal sales and illegal representation. There is not a single Apple store in Russia after all those years. With the president, who is such a consistent Apple fan and evangelist, we don't have an Apple store in our country. This is because if Apple opens an Apple store, with all the taxes and with all the costs such the prices would be different than in the case of personal for-profit imports.
All right, then what do you think about the fact that so many young people find it convenient yet to make a profit from their own friends or their own acquaintances importing illegally these iPads and these products? They, in most cases, I mean, I know at least a dozen people who do that, they don't even think that's a crime.
It's not a crime, definitely. It might be a misdemeanor in case that they arrive to some industrial scale. But if a student brings an iPad or two from the United States, and by selling them, he pays for a year's tuition, I don't think there is even any moral wrong in that.
No, but we've just heard about two young men being, you know, held at the Domodedovo airport for bringing in 20 iPads.
Well, you know, smuggling is smuggling. It is not limited to iPads. People who do serious commerce without registering, without paying taxes, without obtaining licenses and so forth, they are common criminals, and Apple products here are no different from other products being smuggled into Russia on a daily basis, including beverages and cigarettes.
Yeah, that's true, but what I'm saying is that what's unique about Apple is that most people, I've just spoken to them, they don't think they're smuggling. They think they're bringing in, you know, products that are ordered by their friends is just in big quantities. Well, yeah, it exceeds the legal sum, but at the same time, they think there's nothing wrong with doing that.
Actually, there is nothing wrong with doing that. There is a customs rule which simply requires you to pay a customs fee for your product, and that custom tax is just a fraction of the original item price. So the wrongdoing lies strictly in the decision to take the green channel, avoiding the taxes due. And it has nothing to do with Apple. It has something to do with not paying taxes, tax evasion. And Apple products have nothing to do with the decision of a certain person to evade taxes his due. If he really brings that for a friend who asked to bring it, one might expect that the friend should be ready to pay both the price of Apple as required by Apple and the Russian customs tax, as required by the Russian customs.
Anton Nosik, blogger, thank you so much for your time and for your comments on
Apple. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
You're tuned in to the Voice of Russia.
All right, okay. If Nosik doesn't see anything bad about this whole phenomenon of people bringing in apples and, Apple iPads in 20s or 30s.
I'm just trying to imagine how someone brings in 20 units. I mean, how do you pack your bags? You put an iPad between a sock or something? I mean, I'm just trying to think of the actual logistical process of packing your luggage if you're bringing that much stuff with you.
I think it involves a group of people. And they take handheld luggage. You have to still scan it, don't you, before getting
into everything is scanned.
Yeah, then you would be stopped at the U.S. Customs Office, even, wouldn't you?
I don't know. I don't think they check your stuff when you're leaving. I'm trying to think.
Maybe you pretend that you're from some kind of school and you've just bought all these things for your school children.
I don't know. I mean, I've seen people walking with the boxes, like making it known that they do have it with them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just seems kind of weird. Like, I don't even know how you would...
You definitely unpack them, right? But you're going to be selling an unpacked product, which doesn't mean that it's not being used before.
You have to have the boxes somewhere, too. Or yeah. Maybe you unfold the I don't know.
They know better, okay? They know better.
I guess
apparently.
This is why we're not in the smuggling business.
We're not, I guess. But customs duties bring around $160 billion a year to the state budget.
And this is money, well, part of that money is not going to be seen by the Russian budget as long as this
continues,
because the smugglers aren't paying taxes on some rather high-end goods that are coming into the country.
But I think the customs office pretty much knows when a new
product like the iPad comes out.
Exactly. So
they
they're watching for it. I mean, the iPad 2, whatever thing, just came out. So they're at the airport, and they know what to look for.
Yeah, probably stopping young people. I don't know. Maybe not real people, but, you know, suspiciously looking people with big suitcases.
It's kind of funny, though, because, I mean, it's like a game. It's a real gamble. Are they going to catch you or not? Are you their target or not?
If they do catch you, then you're subject to, I don't know, you're in prison sentence.
I mean, you know, I don't know. Of all the things... Like, they didn't even realize that I had a dog. They didn't even care to make sure that the animal that was coming into the country was okay. They just passed me right on through, even though I tried to go through the red line to declare
my dog.
My dog. They're just like, go ahead. I'm going, but I've got, no, go ahead, okay?
That's so weird. But anyway.
I mean, I don't know. So who knows what else is going through? But they're doing their job. I think that's kind of an important thing to point out, is that
you
see this story happening, and they're saying, yeah, okay, we caught these guys, 20 things. It's nice to hear that they are doing something. They're not just letting it all fly.
But it's a huge hassle at the same time for companies doing business in Russia. Even as we've heard from Anton, right? He's saying that it wouldn't make any sense for Apple to start selling its iPad in Russia officially earlier, having to pay all these customs duties.
Of course, because the marketing is the conditions that exist on the market just aren't really profitable, aren't really a priority, as Mr. Moskowitz said. But still, we see the people who want these products and are willing to smuggle them even to get them into the country.
Yeah, but in the end, we see that some companies won't even operate in Russia because of many of these issues.
Of course.
For example, Motorola stopped operating in Russia at all.
Sure, lots of different customs issues and what have you.
Mm-hmm. In December, airport customs people wouldn't let medicine for 6 children into the country. Remember that story?
Yeah, this was really kind of a scandalous, heartbreaking thing when there was medicine that was being bought to this children's charity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was stopped by the customs control. Because, again, I mean, the customs authorities are doing their job.
Yeah, they have rules.
This.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's just kind of an unfortunate consequence of the way that things work. But hopefully, you know, we won't have any scandalous stories like that again. People will kind of understand that if you are smuggling goods into the country, you know, you've got the potential of being caught, of course, but you're also making it more difficult for people who are doing their job to do their job. So why would you, I guess, well, for money, it's all for money, right?
It's all for money. What I'm saying is that, I mean, I have nothing personal against Apple products, except for this craze that makes people sell to their own friends at a premium. That's the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this is all we have time for today on In Between. That was me, Dmitry Vostok.
And me, Donna West.
And now, a look at Russian cuisine.
Hi there, you're tuned to the voice of Russia for Tasty Tales from Marina Sakina.
Today's Russians are very cosmopolitan in their food preferences. In Moscow, every second restaurant offers sushi and no menu is complete without pasta carbonara. Yet notwithstanding all that, there are some foods that have literally been around for centuries and remain perennial favorites to this day.
One such food is kasha. You might have heard me talk about it before. It's an umbrella term for all sorts of grains that can be eaten for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Yet the mother of all Russian grains is buckwheat. Not particularly well known outside of Russia, save for maybe as buckwheat flour. And that's a shame, really, because it is packed with proteins and iron, outpacing all other grains and coming second only to beans. So it's a real wonder food for vegetarians.
Plus, it's got a whole suite of other vitamins, including B group ones, that help you keep a sunny outlook on life, as well as calcium, phosphorus, and iodine. So if you do spot buckwheat grains somewhere, stock up. It's everywhere in Russia, but I hear that you can often find them at Indian specialty stores elsewhere. Aside from being good for you, buckwheat is also really versatile. Once you get the hang of cooking it, you can eat it as a hot porridge for breakfast, use it as a side dish to serve with meat, or make a lovely mushroom gravy and enjoy a hearty bowl for dinner. Cooking it properly is no hard task, you just need to keep in mind a few things. Firstly, even when you do find buckwheat, make sure you don't buy green buckwheat, but rather the roasted brown one. The second trick is sticking to a grain to water ratio of 1-2. This is what I do. I dry roast my buckwheat for a couple of minutes in the pan that I will be cooking it in. All that means is pouring the grains in and moving them around over a medium heat until gorgeous nutty flavors fill the kitchen. Then in with 2 parts of water, and once it comes to the boil, I salt it, turn down the heat, Cover it with a lid and let it cook for about 15, 17 minutes. It's a really good idea to let the buckwheat rest somewhere warm after it finishes cooking too. And that's it. You can eat it warmed up with a good dollop of butter or mix through some fried up mushrooms and onions, or top up with hot milk and enjoy the cereal. There are lots of options, so definitely give this little beauty a try. Enjoy!
This is the Voice of Russia World Service. At 09 hours UTC, we continue broadcasting to Europe on 227 meters medium wave. Listeners in Asia can hear us in the 16 meter band shortwave and on 240 meter band medium wave. We continue transmissions to Australia and New Zealand in the 16 meter band shortwave. And you can also hear us on digital radio in London, UK. Please stand by for the news on the hour, followed by other features. For more information on our broadcast, please visit our website on the internet at english.ruvr.ru, and our email address is world@ruvr.ru.